I think you're going to have a very interesting seminar tonight. My name's Hugh Whittaker. I think most of you know me, but I'm newly arrived at the Nissan Institute. Been here for about a month, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce my former colleague from Cambridge tonight, Professor Peter Kornitzky. Peter actually was educated in Oxford, undergraduate and postgraduate and DPhil, and then he went off to Australia to the University of Tasmania and wandered about in the bush for a few years and surfaced again in Kyoto at the Institute of Humanities at Kyoto University and taught there for 6 or 7 years before returning to the UK and taking up a position at Cambridge University. He became a professor there in 2001. He became a fellow of the British Academy in 2002, I think, and received a Doctorate of Letters from the University of Oxford in 2012. As I think many of you know, Peter's research has been focused on Japanese books and the book in Japan, and he has traveled around Europe, Western Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia, many countries, using his many linguistic skills to catalog old books in libraries that people had neglected. And he has developed a formidable bibliography of rare books and books in general in libraries all around Europe, for which he has been recognized in various awards. He's published a well-regarded book on the book in Japan and recently has edited a series on the book in Asia. So tonight he's going to entertain us with a jellyfish. Peter.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, Hugh. This evening's talk is not really about jellyfish, but any of you who may have read that rather interesting book that came out last year entitled Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of Our Oceans, we realise that jellyfish actually are a very serious threat to nuclear power stations, a very serious threat to fisheries, and a very serious threat to mankind. So the more you can eat, the better. I'm going to be speaking tonight mostly from memory, though I have got some notes with me, just so that I don't make any serious omissions, such as the deficit. Right, let's move on, if I can work this. How does it work? Maybe this. How does it work? There we are. There's the... Not quite sure what I did there. Right, so what I'm going to be doing today, first of all, is introducing you to a very particular book. And then I'm going to explain the serious problem that it raises. And then I'm going to point to a solution, which I think provides the most convincing, at any rate to me, explanation of why it is that a serious technological change took place in early 17th century Japan. Now, I hope you can all see here the page of the book. It's entitled Shoshitsu no Kinkoshu, so the things that are good and the things that are not good for dealing with all sorts of complaints. So it's a kind of teach-yourself book to dietary medicine. And it was written by a character called Baiju, who is largely unknown but lived in Kyoto. He wrote and he published a large number of books in Kyoto, some 30 books, all to do with medical matters. And this particular book is to be found in the Wellcome Library in London. There are a handful of copies in Japan, but not very many. What I want to draw to your attention just for the moment, and you'll realise the significance of it all later, is that the various kinds of plants and food products that are listed there all have their furigana on the side in katakana. And when it comes to the extract from a Chinese work on the left, this work here, Da Xiang Lu, is a late Ming study of dietary medicine, what to eat so that you get better from various illnesses. That bit of Chinese text, which I must have got from an imported version because there was no Japanese edition. That bit of Chinese text comes with all the kunten and other marks to make it a great deal easier to read. And on the far left, you can see the colophon, which is dated 1626. But as I'll explain later, that's actually very unreliable. So that's really the first part of the book. You can see that every section has its title in white letters on a black background to make it easier to see. Now, if we go on to a page from the middle, you can see what the layout is. For every particular syndrome, a symptom you might have, in this case headaches, as you can see here, first of all it lists the good things to eat, and then it lists the things that you shouldn't be eating. And as you can see there, outlined in red, kurage, jellyfish, are among the things that are good for headaches. So next time you have a headache, please contribute to the health of our oceans by knocking back a few jellyfish. Other things that are good, of course, a good old cup of tea, as you can see, daikon, ginger, various other plants. And things you should avoid are listed on the left. Soba noodles, anything oily, tofu's out, chestnuts are out, pears are out, and a whole lot of other things. So you can see that it takes the form of a do-it-yourself manual. You've got a particular set of symptoms. What's good to eat and what's not good to eat? This all comes from a long tradition of Chinese dietary medicine. Only what's happened here is that the plants and the foodstuffs are all made to fit Japan. So things that are only eaten in China are all removed from the sources, and what's presented instead is a kind of Japanized version of what you should be doing for every kind of illness and complaint. And I should say here that you're welcome to try any of this at home, but I do not guarantee that any of these will work. So the book consists largely of sections like this, with the things that are good to eat and things that are not good to eat. And at the end, it has quite a long section on sexuality and how to handle your sexuality in such a way that you lead a longer life, which inevitably means much less sex. Right, if we go on to the next slide, we can see this work in its context, because in the 17th century, or late 16th and early 17th century, there's a huge outpouring of books like this. I've got some of them on the table. If anybody's interested, they can take a look at them. We could pass this rather scruffy one round, and you can take a look at it as it goes round, if you like. I've given on this chart here just the date of composition, or in some cases, first printing, but in every single case but one, these books appeared in numerous different editions. So we're looking simply at the tip of the iceberg here. I haven't even listed all the ones I know about. But we can see that late 16th century, early 17th century, there's an explosion of, if you like, self-help books for dealing with various medical conditions. And the book I was showing you earlier, Shoshitsu no Kinkoshu, is just one of them. And that too appeared in a number of editions. And we can trace these through the booksellers' catalogues of Japan right through to the early 18th century. So there was a big market for self-help medical books that would enable you to at least deal with what you need to do in a dietary sense to deal with headaches and any other condition you may have. Now, I've put one example to go around. You can take a look at it yourself. I will now show two on the slide on the screen so that you can see for yourself. This one is a very similar sort of book, only it's organized by the plants rather than by the illnesses. And as you can see down here, this is by a man called Dorsan, Manase Dorsan, one of the only two names of individuals I will really mention during this lecture to keep that down. Manase Dorsan was active in the 16th century as a doctor, but one who was very keen on Japanizing medicine, and then Japanizing medicine in two senses. One sense was that of making it accessible in Japanese. So many of his works either appeared with kunten, if they were written in Chinese, to make them accessible to Japanese who knew how to read Chinese, or they actually appeared in the Japanese language. And the other sense in which he was interested in Japanizing medicine was in making sure that the plants and the herbs and the medicines that were mentioned were all available in Japan and didn't simply relate to Chinese dietary practices or Chinese flora and fauna. So in those various ways, he was setting about trying to Japanize medicine. And one further example we can see here that is also organized on a similar basis by different kinds of plants. The plants are named at the top, and it gives you the beneficial qualities and the damaging qualities of various plants with respect to particular medical conditions. So instead of using this to look up what do I do with a headache, you can look up instead to see what particular benefits a plant has or a particular herb has, or what it is bad for. So this is more a matter of building up a kind of core of knowledge rather than being a self-help practical book. You wouldn't go to something like this if you had a headache. It was the other kind of book, organized according to illnesses, that would do that for you. And again, it's quite kindly arranged in that there are large numbers of furigana characters added, kana added, all in katakana, to make it a little bit more accessible than a text purely in Chinese characters would have done. And I'll say a bit more about the use of kana in these texts at the end of this lecture. Now, the reason I have focused on this particular book that I showed you at the beginning of the lecture, the one with the recommendation for jellyfish, is that there actually is another edition, and that other edition you can now see on the screen. And to my knowledge, there's only one copy of this extant. You can see that here we have a very different layout. Let me just quickly remind you of what the other one looked like. All right, with all the printed furigana, with the nice dividers in white text on black background, with all the kunten attached to the Chinese text and so on. But when we get back to this earlier edition, printed in 1626, there are no furigana. There's no kunten. Somebody has written in quite a lot of the furigana, the readings of the various plants and foodstuffs, but nothing is provided, and all that divides one section from another is a little simple circle. Why is this one so different? Because this one was printed with movable type, whereas the other one was printed with woodblock. Now let me explain for those who are not as manic as I am about printing techniques exactly what's involved. In Japan, by the end of the 16th century, there were two possible technologies to use for printing books. One was the technology of woodblocks, whereby you print a whole page at a time from a wooden block, such as that you see on the screen there. This technology had been in use in Japan since at least the 12th century, and probably a lot earlier, and continued to be in use until the early 20th century. You print a whole page at a time, and then you can reuse it as and when you wish. Now, the other technology only arrived at the end of the 16th century, and it's the technology of movable type. This arrived more or less simultaneously from two different sources. One was the Jesuits, who established a printing press over in Kyushu in the late 1580s, and began to print, first of all, works in Latin, and then some works using Chinese and Chinese characters, and some even using some kana. They used for that purpose a Portuguese printing press, which they had brought with them all the way from Portugal. And that was one of the sources of knowledge about an alternative technology for printing that reached Japan. The Jesuits printed a large number of works, almost all Christian works, but some of them were also works that were for the benefit of the Jesuits trying to learn Japanese. Remember that Francis Xavier described Japanese as a language invented by the devil to prevent the spread of Christianity. They made every effort to provide reading aids, including by printing a part of Heike Mononotari, which in fact was the first edition of any work of Japanese literature ever to be printed, and it was printed in Roman letters by Jesuits. So that was one of the two sources. The other source was Korea. Korea had been printing with movable type at least since the 13th century. When exactly that knowledge reached Japan is impossible now to say, but certainly when Hideyoshi's troops invaded Korea in the 1590s, they brought back with them printing presses and printing artisans, as well as all the type. So much is a matter of record. So we have these two alternative traditions. Now, one thing I'm not going to go into is the relative weight of those two alternative traditions in influencing the choice of movable type in Japan. There's a huge lot of controversy about it. The most likely is that it was the Korean tradition that had much more influence because the Jesuits were confined to Kyushu, whereas Hideyoshi's troops brought back to Kyoto the printing press, and it was in Kyoto that printing was carried out in the imperial court. But we'll leave that controversy aside because it's not really important. What is important is that from the 1590s in Japan, printers began to start using movable type to print. They abandoned, in other words, the old woodblock printing with using a whole block, but instead used movable type. Here's one example. It was, of course, very easy to do this in the case of Chinese. One piece of type, one character, as you can see here with this collection of writings of Bojui, which was printed in 1618. But Japanese printers were nothing if not inventive, and they gradually began to find ways of printing in Japanese, and even to start to produce some of the calligraphic effects of written Japanese, as you can see here. This actually is a work by that same Manase Dosan, whom I mentioned earlier, a book about maintaining your health and maintaining long life through careful dietary practices and abstention from sex, amongst other things. And he provides here, as you can see, a number of ligatures, bits of type which contain two letters, such as the suru here, the beshi there, there's a mashi here that you can recognize, and so on. So we have an adaptation of movable type in order to make it conform a bit more to the calligraphic qualities of Japanese. And here is another example from the famous series of books printed in Saga in Western Kyoto. This is the Ise Monogatari, and you can see here the same use of ligatures to combine two bits of kana to give a bit of an effect of handwriting rather than one piece of type for every single kana piece. Right. So now I've introduced the two technologies. What happened? Well, what happened is actually very interesting. I'm sorry, the top is just not quite here. This shows the shift from typography, movable type, to back to using woodblock. So as you can see, I started this in 1600. For quite a few decades, for the first 2.5 decades of the 17th century, movable type is ruling the roost. Woodblocks are really at quite a low level. But then something quite radical changes in the late 1620s, and all of a sudden the number of block printed books again starts to rise and reaches quite huge numbers. The numbers of titles on the left relate to the numbers produced in each block of 5 years there. So by the time we get to 1640 to 1644, we've got some 500 woodblock printed titles, but only some 30 movable type. So you can see that the balance is shifting back in favour of woodblock printing. We can see this in a little bit more detail if we go to this breakdown year by year in the 1620s. And you can see how it happens here. And all of a sudden, we're back with woodblock printing again. So the question is, what's happened? Why has the technology been abandoned? Brian, you must have written your thesis on a typewriter.
No, I wrote it by hand.
Would you swap your computer for a typewriter again? Would you go back to using a typewriter?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, you would? Yes. All right. Arthur, what about you?
No.
There we are. So what we've got, what looks like the abandonment of a more advanced technology, one which, of course, Japan took to at the end of the Meiji very rapidly, and which became the dominant mode of production of books throughout the world, at least by the late 19th century. abandonment of that for the age-old system of printing by woodblocks. What is the explanation for that? And this is something that's puzzled people for a long time. And I think, though I'm rather vain, that I've got the answer to this. What are the explanations that have been given so far? The one that Japanese tend not to give, but is given by a lot of Western scholars, is the sheer quantity of characters. Now, you think that in order to print any of those works I showed you, you'd need at least 5,000 bits of type. And that's just for one copy of each of 5,000 characters. You'd probably need a lot more than that. For common characters, you'd need dozens of them. So there seems to be a problem with quantity here. But that's an explanation that I rule out from the start. I rule it out because it was not a problem in Korea. It was not a problem in Meiji Japan when they started printing newspapers with wooden movable type in the 1870s. It was not even a problem for the Tanguts, who were printing in Western China in the 12th century with movable type, and who made large numbers of type, not only for Chinese characters, but for their own rather bizarre Tangut characters as well. So the sheer quantity has not been an obstruction for any of the societies in pre-modern Asia that dealt with movable type technology. So it doesn't seem to be a satisfactory explanation. Another explanation that's had quite a lot of currency is that it was a victim of its own success. What does that mean? It generally is taken to mean something like this. If Arthur comes to me with his latest book and I'm a printer, then I will get out my type and I will set up the book. And then I have to think, let me see, how many copies is this work going to sell? Politics of Japan, let's just say max of 300 here. So I then print it off because I've got a limited amount of type. And then Roger comes along with an idea for a book. So I say, right, okay, well, I've finished with Arthur's book. So I'll now print Roger's book. And I start dismantling the type and setting up Roger's. But then all of a sudden, unexpectedly, the demand for Arthur's book rises. But now I haven't got the blocks anymore. All I've got is the loose type that I'm actually busy using to print Roger's book. So the argument runs something like this. In order to maintain lots of different books in print, it was actually more convenient to use woodblocks than to use movable type. And we can see that little scenario I set out just now actually did happen frequently, because when we find examples of individual books printed by an individual printer and compare them, we find they've often had to do what I just suggested, go back, reset it, because they misestimated exactly how many copies were likely to be shifted. So that's one example of an explanation that carries some weight, but it's not really based closely enough on what was actually happening in the 17th century, because we can't actually document that this happened. It has, I think, some bearing on the explanation, but not a great deal. A newer explanation that's been put forward recently is that typography was too closely associated with Christianity, particularly as the repression of Christianity in the 17th century increased. The argument goes that this made movable type technology, which was associated with the Christians, something that was rather dangerous. Now, this argument, I don't think, carries any real weight for two reasons. One is that Shogun Ieyasu and Hidetada, his successor, used movable type at the same time as they were carrying out suppression of Christianity in Nagasaki. So the Bakufu, at least, does not seem to have had any idea that this technology was associated with Christianity. And the other reason is that, as you saw from the previous slides, the decline of movable technology is not sudden. People realize it's dangerous. It's very gradual, and it takes some 30 or 40 years to happen. So I don't think the statistics can back up that argument. Another argument is capital investment. How does this work? Perhaps we ought to use Hugh as our example here. Imagine that you're a printer trying to weigh up which of the two technologies to get into. Shall I get into movable type or shall I get into woodblocks? Well, if I get into woodblocks, then when I print as many copies of Arthur's book with them as I want, I can sell the wood blocks, and they will be sold and sold and sold. They'll have a long capital life. In other words, the investment you put into carving the blocks is not wasted, because as long as the blocks can be used to print, they can be sold and sold on. And it's certainly a fact that some books that were printed in the 1620s were being reprinted in the 1820s, 200 years later, from the same blocks. So that much is true. The problem is that how many printers in the 1620s realized that this was going to happen? There is no sign that anybody had any long-distance view of the capital investment consequences of making one choice or another. And you can see this in particular from the fact that there's a huge turnover of printers and publishers in the early 17th century. Only one of them who was active in the first 50 years of the 17th century was still active the following century. And that one is still active in Kyoto today, 400 years later. So I'm not sure that this argument really works, because it imputes and requires you to assume a degree of knowledge about long-term economic factors that I think publishers in the early 17th century didn't have. At any rate, we cannot show that they did have. Another argument that is put forward is that Japanese texts, particularly Japanese literary texts, were associated with cursive kana script and with aesthetic qualities of text. This, it is argued, movable type could not really enable to be printed. But in fact, as I showed you with those two earlier examples, it was perfectly possible to use cursive type, and both the Sagabon and other printers experimented with that. So there is quite a lot of cursive type printed in Japanese using the movable type technology. So that argument, I don't think, really holds up. Now, there is another possibility, which is what I'm going to explain to you today. And this is a possibility which comes out of some rather unnoticed developments in movable type. This is not from this book, but this will come into it in a moment. This is from a movable type book, but as you can see, there is katakana all up and down, quite far removed from the characters. And there are only about 10, 15 books like this. They were all printed with separate movable type for the kunten and for the furigana. So that this work is by a Japanese writer, and there are a number of Buddhist works written by Japanese Buddhists in which an effort has been made to make them more accessible to those who are not happy with reading just plain Chinese. And so between the rows of characters, little pieces of movable type giving the kana have been inserted, so that what you get is as near to what was possible with block printing as you could get with movable type. Here are a few other examples. The example on the right shows this with a Japanese text with Oshu, the deep north of Japan, and Hidehira in separate little bits of movable type on the right. In this case here, in order to divide up the text into various divisions, a little bit of movable type with a device is used to add to the visual qualities that again was so easy to do with block prints. And over here, and that's this book here, which you can see later, printed in 1617, the movable type has been used to include bits of Sanskrit, to include various lines, and a whole host of other devices. So these three examples, and there are only about 40 of them altogether, all show movable type printers trying to extend the boundaries of their medium to do things that are very easy to do with block printing, but had not been tried before with movable type printing. They have the effect of making Chinese texts and Japanese texts more accessible by providing furigana, by providing kunten, and providing various explanatory material. So these are people who are experimenting with movable type, trying to make it more accessible. Here is another example, and you can see here that we've got a lot of furigana aside, even besides simple characters like Mono here, almost every character comes with its own furigana, and this is actually a Japanese translation of a Chinese text printed again with movable type. So, now let us come back to that book I showed you at the beginning, but this is the movable type version. All I showed you before was this front page. And that's all that anybody has paid any attention to so far. But as you start turning the pages, you find that a small number of characters actually are provided with their own kunte. Now, this is different, because these are so close as to have been made with the same bit of type. In other words, what we see this character Baiju doing here is making bits of type with the furigana attached. In some cases, it's a pair of them, like here, Daikon. The two characters with katakana furigana at the side. And you can see the other examples here, menui, meaning various kinds of noodle dishes and so on. So Baiju first of all produced this movable type edition. He was straining with the limits of the medium to try to make it more accessible, but he was clearly unable to do this for every single character. Why? I don't know, but he has at least provided on every page some characters with the furigana to provide a reading. As you can see, another reader has gone through by hand and has added all the ones that were missed with the print. And we can see a few more examples here. And on the top right, you can see that we've got Shio written in by hand, but then we've got Menri again. This is a different character from the one that was used before. So he had several characters to represent this. And then I've also shown you, from the same movable type edition, the bit at the back which deals with sexual activity. Now, this is all taken pretty well lock, stock and barrel from a Chinese work, and he hasn't attempted to provide kunten, hasn't attempted to try to make it easier, because that would be a much bigger task using movable type. So that's just left as it is. You might be amused by some of these prescriptions. It tells you, for example, that in May it's very dangerous to make love on the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, the 15th, 16th, 17th, 20th, etc. Really, this is all a matter of preserving health. And that's the latter part of the book. So we've got a book here that in its first edition, which appeared in 1626, Baiju tried his best to make it a little bit more accessible, using movable type in a very novel way by attaching the furigana to the bits of type from the outset. He made the bits of type like that. It was evidently too much of a task to contemplate doing for every single character in the book, and so the amount is rather limited. What did he then do? But he turned back to block printing to produce another edition of it. In this other edition, he copied the original colophon, 1626, and he copied everything else, but he added a lot more. He got rid of the little circles you saw and added these rather fancy headings with white on black. He added all the kunten into the bits of Chinese, and every single character or word that appears in the text comes with its own furigana, all in katakana. So this was something that, of course, it's very easy to do with woodblock printing. You simply carve it onto the block, because after all, woodblock printing is simply a matter of carving something that's written out by hand onto a block. So if I got Joss here to write out something in his handwriting, and then I pasted that onto a block, what I would print from that would be essentially a reproduction of Joss's handwriting. So what Baiju has done here is cannibalized one of his original movable type editions, torn to pieces, and written in by the various characters the furigana. He's also got rid of the subject divisions and added various bits of kunten and so on, and then using blocks printed out a new edition. And probably that appeared in the late 1620s. I say probably because Baijiu ceased activities in 1630. So sometime between 1626 and 1630, this second edition was produced. This, as far as I know, is the only example that exists of a work published by one publisher switching from technology to technology with the same book in the space of just a few years like this. It seems, though of course I can't prove this, that Baijiu was one of the people who suddenly intuited the problem. It was so much easier to use block printing if you wanted to make books accessible by adding furigana, kunten, and other visual devices that made the books a little bit more accessible and easy to read. And he was doing that at precisely the right time, because just at this time in the 1620s, it was becoming more and more common for books to be produced afresh, not using movable type, but using woodblock technology, and using it to add all sorts of additions like kunten, furigana, and so on. As with this example of Igaku Seiden, to use its Japanese pronunciation, which is on the desk here. This is the 1622 edition, and those of you who are interested in such things might like to know that this actually is based on a late Ming edition that has been taken apart and has had kunten and so on added. But the point is that the decision was made not to use movable type in 1620s, but to instead revert to block technology as had been used for centuries beforehand, because it afforded the possibilities of adding so much in the way of diacritics that the other technology could not do. And here is another example from a bit later. This is from the 1640s. This is another medical book titled something like A Record to Save the People, which provides you with basic advice about various medical conditions, what to take by way of foodstuffs, but also what medicines you might benefit from. But you may notice straight away that here we've switched to hiragana. The previous examples all had katakana, and in fact the example of this text that I have here, wherever it is, this one, is in katakana. This one here on the screen is a little bit later from the 1640s, and we have hiragana becoming used in a popular work. And that's an interesting shift that I'll say something a bit more about in a moment. But you see, even the furigana here are all in hiragana. So there's been a shift also in script. Right. Now I'm going to come to some concluding remarks. Okay, I can pour it. The first of them relates to this issue of katakana and hiragana. Before 1600 or thereabouts, let's say 1590, virtually no books were printed with any kana at all, hiragana or katakana. So if you're looking for use of hiragana and katakana before 1590, you have to turn to manuscripts. And there you find a quite interesting division between hiragana being used almost always for works of from the Japanese literary tradition, poetry especially, but not only poetry, all the monomatari, katakana being used in connection with Buddhist texts, in connection with sinological texts, and in connection with medical texts. When I say in connection with, it might be, for example, a lecturer's notes. Lecturing on text was a very common way of providing information in the Muromachi period, and lecturers tended to have notes, but don't we all? And those notes, in the case of Buddhism, Confucianism, and medicine, were almost always written in katakana. And occasionally those led to the development of studies, medical studies or sinological studies, and those too, if they were written in Japanese at all, tended to be written. I say tended, not always, but almost always were written in katakana rather than hiragana. But this rather neat balance doesn't work for the early years of the 17th century. For example, you find editions of the Heike Monogatari, the tale of the Heike, or the Tai Heike, the great piece, being printed with movable type, but in katakana. And these are a very peculiar phenomenon. And so far, nobody has really paid much attention to it, let alone tried to explain it. But what it seems to me to be the likely explanation is this, that those are all rather long texts. And when you're trying to print those with movable type, it is a lot easier if you're using a limited font of katakana rather than trying to represent the flow of hiragana with all sorts of ligatures combining pairs of characters. So I think the push to using katakana for Japanese texts was at least partly driven by the ease of katakana when it comes to using movable type. I don't know if that's the right answer, but I haven't seen any attempt to answer this question so far. So I put it as just a hypothesis. The next issue is that of furigana. We all know how useful furigana are, and in the Meiji period, newspapers came with furigana beside every character, which was a blessing that, alas, we do not have these days. A book was published on furigana, the history of furigana in Japan, in June of this year. But it is, sadly, rather inadequate, because the author has not noticed that furigana, before 1600, only ever appeared in two texts, both of which are editions of the Lotus Sutra. So furigana as a phenomenon before 1600 was confined to manuscripts. And sure, we can find it attached to characters in many manuscripts from before 1600. But if we're looking for furigana in print, then this is something that really only appears at the beginning of the 17th century. And bizarrely, we find it first with these movable type books, where movable type printers are actually trying to get around the technological difficulties and attach furigana to movable type. Baijiu did it by having bits of type with the furigana on the same bit of type. Others did it in separate columns. But we can see that furigana is something that develops with movable type. It's not something that movable type printers look to block printing and then try to copy. It's something they're trying to develop themselves, which is, I think, quite an important point, as I'll mention in a moment. Much the same is true of kunten, those little points and numbers in Chinese text that make them much more accessible to Japanese readers. You cannot find them in any text printed before 1590 in Japan, but you find them appearing in the early 17th century. Of course, in manuscripts, kunten are widespread. You even find in many imported Chinese manuscripts Japanese writing in kunten, but there are no instances of kunten being printed in Japan in Chinese texts until you get to the early 17th century. And yet again, it is the movable type dwellers who are doing that first. They're not trying to copy what they knew to be possible from block printing. They're trying to develop something entirely separately on their own. So when we compare those two technologies and see what advantages they might have held, it's certainly true that, as I pointed out with Arthur's book earlier, that it made a certain sense shifting to woodblocks from the point of view of having lots of books in print at the same time. So I could first of all prepare a set of blocks for Arthur's book. I print off 300 copies and, okay, well, we'll see how that sells, put the blocks aside, and then I can get on with carving a new set for Roger's book. And if Arthur's book tends to be in great demand, then I can haul the blocks out and print as many books as I want while still printing Roger's. So that makes sense when the printing market has taken off. But from the point of view of making the books accessible to a market, and I'm using the word market now advisedly in the sense of a commercial market, then it was woodblock printing that won hands down when it came to providing all the kind of paraphernalia of kunten, furigana, and visual aids in the form of divisions between paragraphs, even illustrations, which at best typography was struggling to do We can see that it was struggling because not many people even made the experiment. One person made experiment of using movable type for illustrations, which is a bit hard to explain, but used a picture movable type. So use the same figure in different pictures to try to put together pictures from movable type. So they were straining with all the possibilities that the technology had, but in the end reached limits. And those limits were particularly strong when it came to trying to reach a larger market and make books accessible to those who cannot read Chinese without the content, to those who need their props of furigana when they're reading difficult names for herbs and so on. So we can see that the typographers made desperate efforts to do this, but in the end, they realized, and Baiju was one, I think, one of the first to realize this, they realized that the things they were trying to do with movable type, although possible, were so much easier to do with woodblocks, and having the woodblocks made it easier, now that you can be a bit more ambitious and print two works at the same time, to do that. So where is all this coming from? First of all, it's coming partly from the fact that there was a market emerging in the 1610s. How do we know this? Because at that time, we start finding the names of merchants and mercantile printers appearing in the backs of books. These are people who are printing in order to make money. Baiju was printing in order to make money. And that is the commercial drive that's behind this, but there is also another drive, and that is the desire to spread information. And this is where medicine comes back in again. I mentioned earlier the name of Manase Dorsai. He and his son and successor were both explicitly, and you find this in their writings, determined to spread medical knowledge to a wider part of the public than had hitherto had access to medical knowledge. In the Muromachi period, if you wanted medical knowledge that was reliable from books, you had no choice but to go to Chinese texts that were imported or printed in Japan. You might, if you were lucky, find a manuscript, but they were few and far between. What Manase was doing was, first of all, Japanizing the knowledge, so removing from the Chinese texts knowledge that was of no use to Japanese because it related to dietary practices common in China, for example, and also making them linguistically accessible. So there is that drive as well. And it is perhaps no coincidence, to conclude in a rather odd way, that the same kind of thing is happening at more or less the same time in Vietnam and Korea, where attempts to make Chinese text more accessible is based on a recognition that a lot of the public, although you'd really like them to be able to read Chinese without any help, let's face it, they can't. And so some kind of reading aids were provided. In the case of Vietnam, it's bilingual editions with the Chinese text on the bottom and a Vietnamese translation on the top. In the case of Korea, it was editions of Chinese text with a large chunk of the Chinese followed by a Korean translation. And we see the same drive towards vernacularization appearing in the early Edo period, particularly in the context of medicine, driven by this desire to make medicine more acceptable and more accessible to the public at wide. And this is what, I argue, is driving the abandonment of movable type towards something that can make that happen much more easily. Thank you for your attention.